boys and girls. Welcome back to Children's Storytime and Dr. Proctor's Fart Powder by Jo Nesbo. We're back with the three friends, Dr. Proctor, Nilly, and Lisa. Nilly squeezed his eyes shut as he scratched inside his ear with his pinky finger. I knocked on the door at the lonely Tombstone pub this morning, but they wouldn't let me in until they opened. Until I explained to them that I was from the Animal Protection Society. You lied? No, I founded the society in my bedroom last night, and I elected myself Chief Executive Officer. See? Here's my ID card. Dr. Proctor put on his swim goggles and looked at the card Nilly held out. This looks like a membership card for the Dolgan School Marching Band, Dr. Proctor said. Only you wrote Animal Protection Society, where the name of the band used to be. It was the only thing I had to write on, Nilly said, and now that my trumpet is defunct, it's not like I can be in the band anymore, anyway. But Nilly, the Animal Protection Society already exists. I think you're thinking about the society that tries to protect animals, Dr. Proctor. And that's not this? No. The Animal Protection Society protects against animals, dangerous animals, which is why I told them that I had recently had an audience with the King and that the Society was working on security for the Greater Oslo region and that anyone caught allowing dangerous animals in their drinking establishments would have to be punished with a noogie, having the soles of their feet tickled, or being sent to jail without internet access. And during my audience, the King at no point expressed any sentiment that these penalties were too harsh for anyone found to have been harbouring dangerous animals. But Nilly, in dismay, Dr. Proctor tugged on his hair, which was even more out of control than usual. That's nothing but lies and trickery from one end to the other. Is not. I did have an audience with the King. My society is dedicated to protecting people from dangerous animals, and as far as I can recall, the King didn't say a single word about those penalties for keeping dangerous animals being too harsh, right? Nilly, Dr. Proctor said, not knowing if he should laugh or cry. Then what happened? Then I read them everywhere. It says about vampire, giraffes and awide. Well, and a couple of scary things I came up with on the fly. So, if they didn't already know they had a dangerous animal in that cuckoo clock, they do now. I can imagine, yes, and what kind of an offer did you make them? I told them that if they gave me the vampire giraffe head on the spot, then and there, that I wouldn't report them to the authorities, and especially not to the King. And voila, they just unscrewed the whole cuckoo clock from the wall and told me they were actually kind of glad to be rid of her. What makes you think it's female? She has such pretty eyes. I think we'll call her Dolores, after the famous can-can dancer. As you wish. Dr. Proctor got out of bed and stretched his arms and legs so his joints creaked. We'd better get started, nailing Dolores onto the rest of Dolores, Nilly. And after that, we have to get a hold of Lisa and test everything to find out if it will even be possible for the three of us to take over as Santas and make sure everyone gets Christmas presents. There's only 2 days left. To be precise, he looked at his watch and scratched his head through his nightcap. Let's see, 24 times 2 minus 38 hours and 20 minutes, Nilly said. Dr. Proctor looked in astonishment at the boy with the freckled button nose. Simple math, Nilly said with a shrug. I see, Dr. Proctor said, but first, Nilly said, breakfast, they cried in unison. Chapter 9, the evening of the day before Christmas Eve. The sun peeked out from between the clouds on this short pre-Christmas day and shone on Tommy, who sat leaning against the base of the Henrik Ibsen statue. Tommy had placed a paper cup on the ground in front of him and was studying the pear soda-coloured fountain and the busy Christmas shoppers darting back and forth buying things. Usually they were extra cheerful right before Christmas and would put an extra coin or two in his paper cup. But this year it was like something was bothering them and they had a bunch of other stuff to think about, like they had to buy more. Well, Tommy thought, that's one thing I don't have to worry about, because Tommy had a warm jacket and just enough money in his cup to buy himself a little dinner. And what more could a man wish for? Well, he could maybe wish for a Cuban cigar, of course, but Cuban cigars were awfully expensive, so that would have to be in some other life, a life in which he was a rich man. But for right now, Tommy was content with what he had, and he figured it was probably about time to go buy a little food. Maybe he even had enough to put a few coins into Olga's paper cup. She was the blind woman who usually sat outside City Hall. And then he'd go back to his tunnel because Tommy was happiest when he was alone and in peace. Too many people made him nervous, and he'd never seen another soul in the disused subway tunnel for as long as he'd lived there. Besides, the sun would be setting soon. "You're nice," a voice suddenly said. Tommy glanced up. A man with a wispy beard and blue circles around eyes stood over him. "I am," Tommy said. "Trust me, I know these things," the man said, then nodded briefly and walked off. Tommy watched him go and thought maybe the man was a panhandler like himself. So Tommy got up, shook the snow off the blanket he'd been sitting on, and peered into his cup. Yep, there were going to be a couple of crowns to give Olga. But there was something else in there too. Tommy fished the oval thing out of the cup. It was wrapped in red paper. He pulled the paper off. What in the world? It was a cigar. Half a cigar anyway, because someone had already smoked the other half of it. But it looked really Cuban. With a cheer in his heart, Tommy stuck the half cigar in his pocket and jogged over to the City Hall. A half cigar after dinner, yes. Or wait, he wouldn't smoke the whole thing, just a little. Then he'd save the rest for Christmas Eve. Yes. It was 7 p.m. and already dark in Oslo. Nilly, Dr. Proctor and Lisa had worked all day, and now they were finally ready for the big Santa test. If things went well delivering gifts in the neighbourhood tonight, then there was no reason to assume it wouldn't go well tomorrow night when they set out to do it for real and deliver presents to the whole world. The vampire giraffe head was attached to the front of the car, which had been modified to look like a giraffe. They'd painted it yellow with black spots, put on the tire chains and wrapped a dozen presents out of things they'd found down in Dr. Proctor's basement. All that was left now was a few finishing touches. Well, really, some finishing brushes. They had to brush the giraffe's teeth. "Nice giraffe," Juliet called to the three friends. She had opened the kitchen window and was watching them as they stood by the car in front of the garage. Dr. Proctor had lengthened the legs, so they had to climb a small ladder to get into the large wicker basket secured to the back of the car, behind where the steering wheel and the gas pedal for the nuclear engine were located. "Her name's Dolores," Nilly called back to Juliet as he petted the giraffe head, "and thanks for the Santa outfits." He ran his hand over the sleek, velvety fabric that Juliet had cut out and sewn together at micro speed and in a micro size. "No problem," Juliet said, "but tell me, why does Dolores have a cuckoo clock around her neck?" "Because giraffes don't have wrists for watches or pockets for pocket watches," Dr. Proctor said as he brushed the giraffe's front teeth with a dishwashing brush. "There, ready for the test run." Dr. Proctor climbed up the ladder and sat down behind the wheel of the giraffe's back. Lisa and Nilly followed and sat down on either side of him on the sheepskin rug Dr. Proctor had spread over the seats so they wouldn't get too cold. "Do you know what, Dr. Proctor," Nilly said, "I should actually be the one to drive Dolores. After all, I am the only authorised test pilot in this car." "You're a test pilot for me," Dr. Proctor said with a chuckle, "so I decide." "Let's go," Lisa said. "Rightio," Dr. Proctor said, and pushed the button that said, "Nuclear reactor." The engine made a crackling sound. He very cautiously pushed on the gas pedal. Dolores' hooves started moving, and the snow chains on the tyres started jingling as I rolled out the gate onto Cannon Avenue. "First stop is number 1, Lily of the Valley Way," announced Lisa, who had been tasked with reading from Stanslaw's old notes. "Just follow the gift positioning for Stanslaw, Doctor." They drove so slowly through the quiet residential streets that Lily complained and moaned and pretended to suppress one yawn after another. After a while, I stopped in front of a greenhouse. "According to the notes, an elderly married couple live here. They wrote a note wishing for a pair of slippers for Christmas," Lisa said. "Here," Dr. Proctor said, holding up a package. "Juliet wrapped my felted wool slippers." "We're giving them used slippers?" Nellie asked. "Well," Dr. Proctor said, "they didn't specify new slippers, and we can't afford to buy new things for the whole world." "And this is a good place to start the test, because according to Stanslaw's notes, this couple is so hard of hearing that Nellie can make quite a racket in the chimney without them hearing anything. Are we sure they're not burning a fire in the fireplace?" "Yep, no smoke from the chimney," Lisa said. "Good. Ready, Nellie?" Nellie had stuck a teaspoon down into the bag of fart powder, and now he popped it into his mouth. "Yum," he said. "I gave it a new flavour," Dr. Proctor said, clearly proud. "Cardamom." "Cardamom?" Lisa repeated. "Yes, a blend of cardamom and cinnamon. Tastes a bit like chai." 3, Nellie said. 2, 1, fart. There was a bang. A small cloud of sheep fur and sawdust rose from the car seat, and Nellie was gone. Lisa squinted into the darkness and saw that her friend had landed atop the roof of the greenhouse. Now he crawled up the side of the chimney and then disappeared. Inside the chimney, Nellie propped his feet and hands out to the side so he looked like a starfish. He cautiously inched his way down. He wasn't so afraid of falling because he still had enough gas in his gut for a fart strong enough to slow his fall. But they'd agreed that it was more important for him not to make any more farting noise than necessary. Besides, the chimney had suddenly grown tighter, so tight that there was no longer any danger of his falling. Yes, so tight, in fact, that he had to bring his arms in against his body to squeeze his way downward. He huffed and puffed and pushed his way down. No wonder Stanslaw hadn't managed to deliver slippers here. A centre belly wouldn't help you get down this chimney. This was a job for a nicely mini Nilly belly. And boy, was it dark. When Nilly's head bumped the side and the chimney made a hollow sound, he suddenly realised he wasn't in a chimney anymore. This was a stovepipe. No wonder it was a tight fit. And as if that wasn't enough, he'd reached a bend in the pipe. He managed to push himself halfway through the bend, but oof, he was stuck. He tried to keep going. He twisted and wriggled, but nothing helped. Nellie decided to crawl a little way back up the pipe and then regroup, but when he tried, he couldn't move that way either. He was wedged in tight, like a cork. "Don't panic," Nellie thought. "Just stay completely calm and don't think about things like not being able to breathe or a carnivorous soot rat or the people who live here deciding it's chilly out, so they're going to fire up the wood stove." Which is when the panic set in. Nellie screamed and yelled and kicked and pounded on the inside of the stovepipe. After he'd done that for a while, he took a break and realised that if he could only slip his backpack off, his problem would be solved. He exhaled all the air from his lungs to make himself a little skinnier, and then, sure enough, he was able to squirm his way out of the backpack straps. And then he managed to wriggle through the bend in the pipe, and then there was more room. A little more wriggling, and the pipe widened, and he saw light. His feet came to rest on what he figured was the bottom of the wood stove. Nellie squatted down. He was inside a wood stove with a glass door. On the other side of the room he saw a big Christmas tree with the Christmas lights turned on, the backs of two armchairs, each with a little grey hair poking up over the edge, and a TV that was on. On the TV, a reporter was standing between the fountain and the Henrik Ibsen statue outside the National Theatre shopping mall. "With Christmas Eve fast approaching," she said, "last-minute holiday shoppers are out in droves. One retailer in particular, Thrain Incorporated, reports that Christmas sales figures have been through the roof this year. The company urges shoppers to remember to run out and buy something expensive right now, before it's too late, because in order to qualify for Christmas membership..." Nellie tried to open the door on the front of the wood stove, but realised it was held closed by a handle on the outside. He tapped on the glass door with his index finger. "Hello," he yelled. "Hello, could somebody open this door?" But the tufts of grey hair didn't move. "Hello, it's Santa Claus. You guys might not believe in me, but could you still help me out?" Still no one moved. "Oh, for Yuletide's sake," Nellie shouted. "Here I come, bringing Christmas presents and stuff." He was so angry, he was jumping up and down inside the wood stove. "Slippers, slippers, slippers." No response. He gave up. Maybe they were dead. Maybe they'd had strokes or infected each other with a nasty pneumonia, died, and now they'd been sitting in front of the TV for days or weeks while the phone rang and relatives knocked on the door and left again. But no, they probably weren't dead, because one of them was changing the TV channel now. First, to a channel where they watched a bunch of Chinese people run in and out of a department store with their arms piled high with wrapped presents. Then to a channel where the king regarded the microphone being held up in front of him soberly before beginning to speak. "I have just come from a meeting with the Finnish president, and he is extremely angry at Norway," the king began. "He claims that Finland is a true owner of Christmas, not Norway, and he threatened us." "How did the Finnish president threaten Norway?" the reporter asked.
He sounded very threatening, and he also had a very threatening look on his face. Kind of like..."
The king lowered his eyebrows and the corners of his mouth, but Nellie thought it actually made him look more tired than threatening.
"Exactly what did the Finnish president say?" the reporter asked. "How the heck should I know? I can't really speak Finnish. I can only count a little."
The king cleared his throat and started counting. Nellie sighed. This was only a test run right now, but if they were going to deliver millions of presents on Christmas Eve, they couldn't spend this much time on each one. He set the wrapped slippers down in the oven, hoping that they would notice the gift before they lit their next fire, and then he climbed back up the stovepipe. Ah, and got stuck in the bend again. It was a Santa outfit. It was too thick. Nellie crawled back down into the oven again, unbuttoned the suit, and pulled it off. He was about to climb back up the stovepipe again when he spotted an old grey-haired man standing in the middle of the living room, staring at him with his mouth hanging open and a coffee pot in his hand. "Magda," the man said, "there's a naked boy in the wood stove." "Yes, yes, Elf," an old woman's voice replied from the chair that still had a grey tuft. "You need to remember to take your medicine, you know. Did you get the coffee?" The man looked at Nellie, then sighed, turned around and walked back toward the TV with small, shuffling steps. "What took you so long?" Dr. Proctor asked as Nellie tumbled onto the sheepskin beside him. "And why are you naked?" Lisa asked. Long story," Nellie said, shivering as he pulled on his Santa outfit. "What's the next stop?" "Number 9 Spitsbergen Drive," Dr. Proctor said, and stepped on the atomic pedal. This time Dr. Proctor pushed just a smidge harder on the gas pedal, and they whooshed through the darkness. They took a shortcut over a field and through some woods with snow-laden branches. Then they came out onto a road again as it began climbing towards the houses up on Spitsbergen.
But the fog had come in, and the higher they went, the thicker it became. Finally, they could hardly see anything ahead of them. "I can't see any house numbers," Lisa said. "I can't even see any houses," Nilly said. "Some jet reindeer would have been nice right about now," Dr. Proctor said. "They can find their way in any kind of weather." "Maybe that's number 9 over there," Nilly said, pointing to a large white house they could just barely make out through the sea of fog. They heard boys' voices hollering and laughing from inside the house. "What makes you think that particular house is number 9? Lisa asked. "I don't know," Nilly said. "Maybe because we hear boys' voices and it says on the skiff that it's for a boy named Ola," Nilly said, holding up his hand. But Lisa didn't see anything in Nilly's hand, just a red ribbon with a tag that looked like it was dangling in thin air next to his hand. "Is that?" She reached her hand out and felt her fingers bump into whatever he was holding. "Yes," Dr. Proctor said, "it's the invisible boomerang, and we're going to have to hope that Ola lives here. If not, then some other boy will be the lucky one. Hot to it." Nilly helped himself to another spoonful of fart powder, felt the delightful tickle in his belly, bent his knees, aimed at the chimney, which he could just barely make out through the fog, counted to 3, and bang! An air stream erupted from his backside and he lifted off the seat. He hit perfectly right next to the chimney and climbed up it and then down into it. Luckily, this time the chimney was big and wide the whole way down. In fact, it was so wide that Nilly practically had to do the splits to reach the sides with his feet. As he approached the light beneath him, he heard boys' voices coming from the living room. "And we're going to win the big snowman contest this year with Dad. Oh, yeah. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah. Because he rented a bulldozer." "A bulldozer?" a girl's voice said. "But you're not allowed to use anything other than your hands in the big snowman contest." Then the boys' voices again. "Duh. That's why we're going to build the snowman tonight, where no one's watching, bonehead. And our snowman will be so huge that no one else will have a chance, especially not you, blockhead. And if you say a word about the bulldozer to anyone, then we're going to crush you, knucklehead." Nilly thought there was something weirdly familiar about those voices, but there wasn't time to think about that now. He would just have to drop the present down into the fireplace from here and get away before anyone noticed him. Nilly tossed the boomerang and it started climbing back up when it occurred to him what boomerangs did. You threw them and then they curved around and came back to you. Nilly had only just finished thinking that thought when he felt something hard and invisible thwack into his knucklehead, or blockhead, or bonehead. Regardless, he lost his grip and fell. Nilly landed on something soft. He coughed and spit and realised he was lying in a massive pile of ash. Then he heard laughter and someone screaming, "Bloody murder," and when he looked out at the kids, who were all staring at the fireplace, he realised why their voices had sounded so familiar. "Look, it's a dwarf," Tors exclaimed. "Hey, you weren't invited to our Christmas party," Trim yelled. "You're not even a member of Christmas, you penny-pinching cheapskate. Get him." Nilly looked out at the other kids in the living room. They stared back at him. Trolls and Trim started for him. "We're going to crush you now, you cranberry." Trolls laughed. "And serve you with our Christmas dinner," snarled Trim. "Yeah," Trolls taunted. "The roast pig won't have an apple in its mouth this year. It'll have a dwarf." Nilly watched the twins waddling closer. They were very big for their age and really ghastly to have such pleasant names as Trolls and Trim. And Nilly didn't have much time at all if he didn't want to end up as a garnish for their Christmas meal. He fumbled around in the ash. His fingers found what they were looking for. He looked down, saw nothing, and threw the nothing at the twins. "Ow!" Trolls howled, grabbing his forehead. "What was that?" "Uh-oh, looks like Nilly is in trouble here,"
Those boys, Trules and Trim, sound like real bullies, don't they? Next time, Nilly meets Mr. Thrain. Till then, happy reading. Goodbye.
This program was produced at and first aired on Coast Access Radio, supported by Erirangi Te Motu, New Zealand On Air. Stay up to date with the latest episodes, available on accessmedia.nz.